I want to see science serve a useful purpose to improve the standard of living for all people.
Hey, why is anyone fighting food advance? A very small percentage of the world's population is fortunate enough to have the luxury of turning down food.
We've arranged a society based on science and technology in which nobody understands anything about science and technology.
You can't build a peaceful world on empty stomachs and human misery.
You're listening to Talking Biotech, the weekly podcast illuminating issues in agriculture and medical biotechnology. Your questions and concerns are answered using a science-based approach with the goal of driving innovation to application with communication. Now here's your host, Dr. Paul Vincelli.
Welcome to the Talking Biotech Podcast, the weekly podcast where we discuss contemporary issues in science and technology with a focus on biotechnology and new innovations that can help people and the planet. I'm Paul Vincelli, sitting in for Dr. Kevin Folta. Once again, thanks, Kevin, for the chance to do this. And today we're going to be talking about transgene flow, a topic I've had a long standing interest in. And we have one of really the people whose work I've read quite a bit of today in the program, and her name is Dr. Carol Mallory Smith, professor of wheat science from Oregon State University, and welcome to the program, Carol.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. So before we go into the technicalities of transgene flow, let me just give you a chance to say something about yourself. I see you're in the Department of Crop and Soil Science at Oregon State, and really just tell us something about your background and your career interests or anything that helps the listeners get to know you better.
Okay. I've been a professor at Oregon State University since 1994. I am in the Crop and Soil Science Department. I have worked in several different areas in weed science, from very applied research, working with just weed control and herbicides testing. But I've also had an interest in genetics and then this interest in gene flow in the environment. And part of the interest is transgene flow, but I've also worked on gene flow of other genes that really aren't transgenic at all. They're just genes that would be moved during hybridization between crops and weeds, and so I've had an interest in that for a long time. I have worked with Roundup Ready creeping bentgrass. That's where I've looked at a lot of the gene flow that's occurred in the environment with that particular crop.
Mm-hmm. So just for the benefit of the listeners that maybe have not heard that term before, tell us what a transgene is.
Well, the transgene is a gene that's been engineered to have a trait, but it also has other parts to it that are can help it be placed in the plant, get it turned on and turned off in the plant within the gene that of interest. So it's going to be a gene that was put in, which is going to result in a particular trait of interest.
And particularly a gene or genetics that come from outside the normal breeding pool. Is that a fair description?
Yes. So you could get the trait through sort of what people would consider conventional. If it actually exists in the germplasm, you could do it through conventional breeding or even other techniques that aren't considered transgenic breeding, for example, mutation breeding, which is not considered transgenic breeding. So in this case, you're actually inserting a gene that's going to be coming from a different species generally to be put in there. And that gene actually could come from, for example, a bacterium and be placed into a crop.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which is, in fact, what the Roundup Ready or glyphosate tolerance trait is it not? It's a gene from a bacterium that was inserted into creeping bentgrass in this case.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. So it's really a pleasure for me to be able to talk to you about this subject. I think I may have emailed you and told you this, but I assign your Journal of Applied Ecology paper from 2008. I assign that as a reading in my graduate course on genetic engineering of crops, risks and benefits, because it's really, in a single paper, really gives the students a very nice introduction to what can happen, you know, in terms of when a transgene is introduced into an open pollinated wind disseminated species, and wind pollinated species, I should say. So tell us about the facts of this situation, you know, the glyphosate tolerance or Roundup Ready creeping mintgrass out there in Oregon from the beginning.
So, yeah, that's a little bit of a long story from the beginning, but this particular crop is a transgenic crop that was bred to be resistant to the herbicide glyphosate or Roundup. It was produced by Scotts and Monsanto in a joint venture, and in the about 2002, it was planted as a field for seed production. So it wasn't really a research project at that point in time. The companies were expecting deregulation soon and were ramping up for actually the sale of the seed. So they had planted this crop in multiple fields within a particular area in Oregon for seed production. And during that first year, after the seed was ripe, and the way that we actually produce grass seed is to cut it, swath it, let it lay on the ground to dry out, and then we come back through and thresh or combine after that. And during that time period, between the time that the field was cut and when it was harvested, a wind storm came through and actually moved panicles with seed off of one or more of those fields and moved it across the landscape. So it was sort of a unique situation where this seed was moved around, along with, of course, pollen being moved around at the same time. And so it was a big opportunity to study what happens when you have an open pollinated perennial crop that is wind pollinated, which also had sexually compatible relatives in the same area. So there was an opportunity to actually sort of watch in real time what would happen when you have a transgene put in the environment. And so we were able to follow that over time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It appears to me that you know, just as an aside, your writings on this subject are very much, measured science. And so I appreciate that. I imagine as you went forward in this project, there's been some challenges because of the stakes potentially involved. But so by the way, this 2008 paper for the listeners. This is a open access paper, so people can read it if they're interested in it to learn more. But so it basically glyphosate tolerant escapes were being found in 2003, the year after planting. Is that right?
That's correct. Yes. So yeah, it within that first year, we saw pollen flow, with compatible species, and so we were finding hybrids within that first year. But we also were finding the plants because of both pollen and seed movement. So we were able to find both hybridization and seed movement in that first year.
In that first year. Okay. And then there's beautiful maps in the paper, and unfortunately our listeners can't see those unless they go online, of course. Before I forget, the title of the paper is, let's put that on in the podcast, it's Escape and Establishment of Transgenic Glyphosate-Resistant Creeping Bentgrass, Agrostis stolonifera. And I think if you Google that much, you're going to find the paper pretty easily. But you've got these great maps, and what it looks to me like, as I've interpreted this, there's basically 2003, the first year of detection of these glyphosate-tolerant plants, is the map with really the fewest hits or fewest plants that were positive for the glyphosate-tolerant transgene. And then as we go into 2004, 2005, and 2006, there are greater and greater numbers of hits. How do you account for that? What do you think is going on there?
So So in 2003, what we would have been really looking for is just pollen movement, because they were planted in 2002. We would have seen pollen movement 2003 in what we collected. But then in the future years, we would have, it would have been a relation, you know, a reflection of how much seed had moved in those and pollen in that after that first year of production. So we really didn't expect to find any plants in 2003, because we would have just been looking for pollen movement off of the fields.
Makes sense.
So that would be incompatible species. But in the following years, then we saw the actual movement off the fields of both pollen and seed.
So if you look at those maps, I mean, it's easy to come away with the impression that the occurrence of these glyphosate tolerant plants was greater and greater as, you know, through 2006. Is that that's what it looks like. But I think your paper also says you sampled more plants. So do you think it was spreading during that time
it's really sort of interesting. And yes, I think it was spreading, even though the total number of plants could have gone down over time, because at the same time that we were doing all of this sampling and this survey work, Scott's was responsible for actually going into those same areas and removing these plants, because it was still regulated. And because they were responsible legally to remove those plants, they were removing them at the same time we were surveying. And so we weren't going to exactly the same sites every year, and we couldn't resample the same plants every year to see if they were moving. Mm-hmm. So even though in some cases, in 2005, I think probably we were finding as many as we were in 2006. So it's possible that by 2006, we were starting to actually see some reduction in the number of plants that were out there, but we were still seeing them widespread.
Okay. So the number could have been going down, eventually did go down in the sample period because of Scott's efforts to remove plants that were positive. But there continued to be evidence of some degree of spread, is what you're saying.
Yes.
Okay.
And since this survey, we have found them spread, you know, into even more areas. The numbers are still in this particular area where those fields were planted. The number of individual plants is down, but we're still finding them there, which is 14 years later, we still find the plants quite easily, and we can also have found hybrids between creeping bent grass and another species called red top, which is a related compatible species, and we have found hybrids between those two as recently as this year.
Okay, red top, yeah. And rabbit's foot, are there? I think I read something about rabbit's foot creeping bent hybrids. Is that a different species? And am I mistaken about that?
No, that's a different species. In fact, that species is even in a different genera. So we have interspecific crosses, and we also were looking at intergeneric crosses, which we have found.
Okay. So, I should have said in the beginning for the listeners that one of the reasons of significant concern about this is that Oregon is one of the world's major grass seed producers, principally in the Willamette Valley to the west of the Cascade Mountains, whereas these outbreaks that you're describing of glyphosate-tolerant creeping bent are to the east of the Cascade Mountains. But that's certainly, there's a lot of concern among seed producers, right, in Oregon. Tell us about the perception of growers and that dynamic.
Okay, so actually in the area where those original crop fields were planted near Madras, Oregon, there is grass seed production in that area, not as much as there is in the Willamette Valley. And most of the breeding is in the Willamette Valley, which there was a lot of concern about making sure that this species was kept away from where our biggest breeding areas are. Okay. But there is some production of seed near Madras.
The area where the introduction was, the experimental introduction was made, is that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
And then we do produce other seed in that area where there is concern that that certain markets which are extremely sensitive to any kind of genetically engineered contamination would be a problem. Mm-hmm. Even though they're not compatible species, the potential for having just a positive test come back could cause disruption of some of the markets.
Right. And you could get a positive test. As I thought about this, I realized a positive test could occur from pollen from creeping bent to another creeping bentgrass field, or it could occur if there were some stray volunteer plants or scattered plants of weeds of glyphosate positive or glyphosate tolerant creeping bentgrass in a field that it wouldn't hybridize with but may contaminate.
Yes,
that's part of the concern. Mm-hmm.
That's okay. Part of the concern. And you can even get positive tests from just tissue, you know. So you could just be a positive test from a piece of a plant that had, you know, sort of has nothing to do with the crop that you're growing.
So you would get a PCR positive even from dried grass tissue, wouldn't you?
You can, yes.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah, I can see where this is. So I imagine, I can imagine there's certainly a lot of tension in the area over this issue. So a recent development, let's see if I have this this correctly, the APHIS in last month decided to, which by the way, folks, stands for the USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, or APHIS. And APHIS announced it was deregulating the glyphosate-tolerant creeping bentgrass. And so, am I right about that? And tell us more about that situation.
So there's a little bit of a lead into that, in that we've been talking about this area near Madras, Oregon, Jefferson County, Oregon. But in addition to the escapes that were in that area, then in Malheur County, Oregon, which is closer to the Idaho border, where there was never any of this bentgrass grown, in 2010, we found a fairly large infestation of Roundup Ready creeping bentgrass along the waterways in Malheur County. Okay. And so there's been a cleanup effort there also. So it's not just that we have just one area in the state that has creeping bentgrass, but another site in the state. So with that, again, Scotts has had a fairly big effort to control this regulated species in that area also. That escape likely came from fields that were grown in Idaho, but there's, you know, it's not actually 100% confirmed how those plants actually got there.
So there are creeping bentgrass, or were creeping bentgrass, glyphosate tolerant creeping bentgrass fields in Idaho as well?
Yes, there were small fields. Okay. I think around 2005, actually after Oregon asked them to remove their fields from Oregon. They did some production in Idaho.
Wow.
So, 2010, the plants were found in Malheur County, quite widespread. So there was an effort there. But in the meantime, of course, this is still regulated. Scotts is having to do this mitigation plan because it's regulated. And as long as it's a regulated article, they were responsible for doing this. So in 2015, between APHIS and Scotts, there was a memorandum of understanding and a memorandum of agreement that about how Scotts would move forward with managing and mitigating what was going on, and especially in the two counties where it was more widespread. At the same time, and I would say this was not a very transparent process, where they really didn't let people who were involved actually know what was going on behind the scenes. But in the meantime, they had some agreements. Scotts withdrew their petition for deregulation, then resubmitted it, which is what was in and has now been approved by APHIS. Mm-hmm. So with that approval, it means now it's deregulated. So Scotts is really not at this point responsible now for removal or mitigation of this problem in Oregon.
I mean, that's official, right? The APHIS
is official. It was deregulated, yes.
Yeah. And so I think when we first spoke in anticipation of this interview, I think you gave a phrase I wrote down, and that is basically the deregulation means if you don't want the glyphosate tolerant grass in your property, you must get rid of it. It's no longer the responsibility of anybody else.
That's correct. So at this point in time, APHIS is ruling their final decision basically said it would be up to the growers to control it, and that the growers should be able to control it and there shouldn't be any problem, even though after more than 10 years, Scotts hasn't been able to control it. All of a sudden, now it's an Oregon grower problem to control it.
Okay. Wow. Well, there's certainly more to discuss, and including lessons learned. So let's take a short break. And so we're talking to Dr. Carol Mallory Smith from Oregon State University. And she's a professor there of wheat science and has been for many years. And when we come back, we'll continue to discuss the particulars of the transgene flow of glyphosate-tolerant creeping bentgrass in the Pacific Northwest. Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech Podcast.
Today, a note about auto wrecks, podcasts, and happy endings. A note to the Talking Biotech Podcast comes from Jenny from Bemidji, Minnesota. She says that she was listening to the Talking Biotech Podcast while driving late on a snow-covered country road. She hit a patch of black ice and ended up losing control of her vehicle, rolling and landing upside down. She was unable to call for help as she was unable to find her phone. But wherever it was, it continued to play the Talking Biotech Podcast. She was trapped there for over an hour, cold but unharmed. Thank goodness for airbags. She wrote, "I closed my eyes and listened to the podcast. Kevin and Paul kept me company until help arrived." She was able to enjoy two complete episodes of the Talking Biotech Podcast and said that the soothing messages of science made a desperate time much more pleasurable. Thank you for letting us know, Jenny, and proud to be your podcast Jaws of Life. Share your experiences or interests with us at talkingbiotech@gmail.com. And now, back to the podcast.
And we're back on the Talking Biotech Podcast with Dr. Carol Mallory Smith, talking about transgene flow in creeping bentgrass in Oregon in particular, but also concern maybe out even beyond Oregon. So, Carol, you've worked in this area and done some very good science over the years. Lessons learned is kind of the theme I'd really like to explore here in the final part of the interview, and we've got certainly time to do that. Start by telling us, a key lesson and key observation that you've learned.
Well, I think the one big lesson to take from this example of the creeping bentgrass is that it's a different kind of crop. You know, it's an outcrossing species, has sexually compatible relatives that it can cross with. It has extremely small seeds, so it's very hard to contain. Often when it does escape and it's a volunteer, it's going to be in areas where it's very difficult to see because it could be mixed in on these irrigation canals or whatever with a lot of other grasses. And so you have to actually be able to identify it, which is not necessarily that easy in some of these areas. So I think in the beginning, I think this was the biggest sort of error that was made, was when the regulators started thinking about this crop. They'd already deregulated quite a few Roundup Ready crops. So they had, soy and corn and cotton. And these crops were grown on really widespread acres, millions of acres. But those crops are very different than creeping bentgrass. So creeping bentgrass is a perennial, It's going to be in the environment. It can last, you know, several years out in the environment. Again, hard to identify in the first place. Lots of compatible relatives to hybridize with. And it's just so different than the crops that they had regulated before. I don't think they took that into account, even though there were people who warned about that this could happen. It really wasn't taken into account the way it should have been. And I don't think they really realized what could happen with a crop like this. And so I think in the end, that's one of the big lessons, is to think about the biology of the crop. And I don't think it's the trait so much that you need to be concerned about in a lot of cases, but rather the biology of the species and what could happen with that transgene in the environment.
Mm. Yeah, that seems all very, you know, understandable. Yeah, this is great, because I, like, next week is the week that we're going to read your paper from the Journal of Applied Ecology in my class, and so I'm going to have I'm going to have some more notes to share with them. This is this is really good. So what else? I mean, what else have you? That's certainly enough, but what else have you learned, or that we can learn from?
Well, I think the other thing is this whole idea, and I think I've written this before, is once a gene's placed in the environment, it's going to stay in the environment. You can't, you know, you can't redact them or retract them. They're going to be out there. And so before you do that, I think the whole idea of what can happen with the trait itself, is the trait itself going to be different? Is it going to cause some problem that could actually, especially if it's moved to a weed species, is it going to be able to make that weed more competitive? And in the case of the Roundup resistance, that's really not the case unless you're using Roundup.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But with the example of creeping bentgrass again, creeping bentgrass really likes to be along water, and it's along waterways. About the only really effective herbicide that we have to control weeds along waterways is a formulation of glyphosate. So now we have lost the best herbicide that we could for control of this species. And so when you apply the glyphosate, which irrigation districts are still going to be doing to control other weeds, they're actually selecting for the glyphosate resistant weeds out there. So you're increasing the populations that way too. Yeah. So I think it's a big picture. It's taking the big picture of what are all the repercussions that can happen? So again, trait and biology of the species.
So so if I understood correctly, the best herbicide to use along waterways, whether it be creeping bentgrass or any other grasses, is going to be routinely the use of glyphosate.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah. So really, you're just guaranteed to select for the glyphosate tolerant bentgrass.
Yes, exactly, which is the problem that now is left to the growers, because their best option for control is now gone.
Yeah. That's...
And so really it's placing the burden back on individual growers or irrigation districts to control this weed.
Right. Yeah, in fact, that was one of the really good quotes, you know, that from your paper. And so to back up just for a minute for the listeners, the deregulation of the glyphosate tolerant creeping bentgrass from APHIS, that statement made the point that in the absence of glyphosate, the creeping bentgrass that's tolerant is no different than other creeping bentgrasses, and is not more invasive, is not noxious. And so it's a weed like any other. So in that sense, you know, they felt that it, you know, I guess that was part of their defense for not considering it an invasive weed. But the elements that you're adding to this situation include the fact that, you know, you really don't want to treat this plant as you might treat a glyphosate tolerant corn or soybeans, and secondly, it's been introduced to the environment, and so once introduced, it's maybe very difficult, unless there's a fitness cost to the gene, there's very difficult to reel that back in.
Exactly. And with the glyphosate resistance, there's been no evidence that there's a fitness cost.
Okay.
So you would expect that those plants to just be maintained out there unless there's some other kind of weed management that's done to remove them. And in some cases within fields, like if they're in a grower's field, there may be some other options, both with tillage and with other herbicides. But along the waterways, there's very little that anybody can do.
Yeah. Okay. Wow, that's good. Good stuff. I'm glad to learn this. So you said when we talked on the phone, you said you're not anti-GMO, and whether you are anti or pro or in the middle or agnostic, I think is another term you used. Yeah, it is. We're glad to have you on the program, but I think it's interesting to note that your concerns about this situation are not coming from a sort of an ideology or perspective that you wouldn't want any use of genetic engineering. But this particular instance certainly has its challenges, particularly in so far as it may impact eventually seed producers.
Yeah, that's correct. You know, and even the growers in the areas where they have to do the removal, especially in Malheur County, there are a lot of Roundup Ready crops grown there. They grow Roundup Ready sugar beets, and they grow corn, and they grow alfalfa. So it's not that even the growers who are now responsible for removal are anti-GMO. Mm-hmm. They just want this problem to be taken care of by the responsible parties.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Well, this is a story to be continued, I'm sure.
Very possibly.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to continue and follow. It's certainly a upsetting situation, but it certainly will be interesting as well to follow it. So, if listeners wanted to learn more about your program, where would you send them, or what could they do?
Well, they can look online for me, but I mean, they can contact me, or there's the publications that are out there, comments that are out there are all public.
Mm-hmm. And we'll put your website on the lead page for the
sure.
This version of Talking Biotech podcast. So yeah. So is there anything else you'd like the listeners to know?
I guess the last comment I would have is that. The regulations that were dealing with these genetically engineered crops, you know, they were put together in like the mid-80s, and that it's called the coordinated framework, and they were put together in the mid-80s. And so now we're trying to deal with especially all the new technology that's coming along, things like CRISPR and other new techniques, you know, that are coming along in, you know, 2016, 2017, and in the few new years to come. We're trying to regulate them under regulations that came from 1986, and I might be wrong on that date, but it's pretty close. So, you know, the regulations are out of date. The regulations are way behind the science. And so it's really interesting, I think, to watch what's going to happen in the future with some of these new techniques and how they're actually going to be regulated or who's going to try to regulate them. And so I think that's one of our biggest problems, is that we're working with really out of date regulations for these crops.
Yeah, good. All right, thanks. Well, listen, Carol, it's been a pleasure to interview you. I cannot thank you enough for coming and sharing your knowledge about a situation that probably has some certain tension around it. So once again, thanks for joining us on the Talking Biotech podcast.
Okay, thank you.
And thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast. Follow us on Twitter @TalkingBiotech. Write a review on iTunes and tell a friend to listen, as your support allows us to deliver more about exciting science to more people. I'm Paul Vincelli, and thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast. Please send your suggestions for guests, comments, or questions to talkingbiotech@gmail.com. Please write a review on iTunes and recommend this podcast to a friend. More downloads and reviews raise the visibility of this podcast and help us reach a wider audience with science.